Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just continuing with the saga of maybe going, or she's a teacher in a school, you know the situation by now, and it's a rough enough school. And last week, you may remember, there was a fire alarm, and she had to evacuate the class, and she decided to, and that's what she did. So, dear principal, 11:20 a.m., it was so nice to meet you in person at the fire drill assembly point in the front yard. It's so long since I've seen you in person that I hardly recognised you. It was an encounter that had all the charm of novelty about it. Running into you is such a rare occurrence, like meeting a celebrity. Admittedly, the burns had changed your appearance dramatically, but as they say, it's an ill wind that blows no good. At least it got you on the move, into the open air, and frankly, I've always said it would take a bomb to shift you, but it seems that the fire in your office did the trick. It's just amazing, isn't it, what the smallest little spark can turn into, given the right set of circumstances and a hot air heater? Isn't it, though? It really is. Now, I was surprised to see you in such distress about your hair being singed so badly, because honestly, there was so little hair there in the first place that the loss, though regrettable, should not be exaggerated. At least it now opens the way, clearly, for a good wig. No more pretense or agonizing over a vanishing amenity. I always feel that the one thing to be said for a scorched earth policy is that it makes room for things that otherwise would never have seen the light of day. Now, it's comforting to know that nothing really important has been damaged by the fire. It was only yourself, your office, and the library, wasn't it? So, on consideration, I suppose the library is of some importance. Not that any of our pupils would read a book, of course. Heaven forbid. But I have always found it useful to have something to threaten them with. It is wise, I feel, to have something to bring an English class to on those occasions when things are not going one's way. When the pupils are beginning to move menacingly towards one's desk, one's mind tends to seek intellectual options. The library is definitely an important safety valve to have, a means of tactical retreat, as it were, when things start to get ugly. I do hope, therefore, that the library will be refurbished as a matter of priority. 11:40. I must say I feel refreshed after the adventures of the morning. I regret, of course, that because of the fire, I have missed my class at 6 a.m. in the metal workroom. They are such a committed class and show such application. The last time I was supervising them, that was for Mr. Jones at the hospital, having his leg bandaged, remember? They were making a very impressive mace, and have all become expert horseshoe makers. What they intend to do with horseshoes, I have no idea. Do they think that horseshoes are the way of the future, I wonder, or just that they will make them lucky? Some have become expert at throwing them. That could be very unlucky for someone. They have such an interest in the medieval world, that group, the youth today. What will they get up to next? A portcullis to prevent teachers entering the room, perhaps? Or a catapult to facilitate a quick departure from school? 11:59. I'm off to 1 hour next for last class of the morning. We'll keep you posted. Yours, Maeve. Dear Principal, 104. I have just arrived in 1 hour for the last class before lunch. The OR stands for remedial, doesn't it? A colleague of mine said to me as he was coming out of the class that he could think of a good remedy for the class, all right, but he didn't think it would be sanctioned by the Department of Education. I won't tell you what else he said about you, because you have had enough stress for one day. Now, I know from experience that children can often get hungry in this last class of the morning, but I have to say that it still shocked me to find Robert Kennefic with his teeth sunk into the arm of Bay Chopra. I understand Mrs. Chopra called her son Bay, as she was, while pregnant, putting some bay leaves into the soup when he first kicked. He's been kicking ever since. No. Vampirism. That's just a myth, isn't it? Come on now, it is. Of course it is. How could I even think? Why do they show so much of that vampire stuff on TV? What is wrong with our society? I really do think it's time for them to take Buffy off the screen. They're still showing reruns. Can you believe it? And these vampire films seem to go on eternally. It's bloody ridiculous. It may be giving the younger generation unfortunate ideas. Anyway, I know you'll be pleased to hear that I plan now to take immediate and decisive action to separate Bay's arm from Robert's teeth. I have decided to keep them apart by a desperate, but I feel necessary resort. 12:10. The class is being disturbed by the banging from the storage press. I have gone to the door several times already and told Robert that under no circumstances will he be let out until he promises that he will control his appetite. There was a whimpering sound then, and the banging ceased. 12:14. We can hear scratching noises emanating from the interior of the press, like the fingernails of a dying man on the surface of a locked door as he sinks in a last pathetic appeal for help. I don't care. Drac is not getting out. 12:17. I can hear whining cries like those of a cat coming from the cupboard, but they don't bother me. You can hardly hear them now anyway, with the stamping on the floor and the banging on the desks by the class who are demanding Drek's early release. 12:19. The pupils are continuing with their protest in an effort to get the pupil released, but I've passed sentence and that is that. I am immune to pressure. The lady is not for turning. This lady does not teach vampires. That's vinyl. 12:22. I have relented and released Robert, although I'm still not entirely sure that the danger has passed. I find myself casting nervous glances in his direction from time to time. 12:26. I have decided to give Robert the duster, which I have told him he may sink his teeth into if he feels anything coming on. I have to keep a close eye on him now, so must break off here, Principal, but will write again before the end of this lesson if I have not been eaten by then. Your resourceful teacher, Mayus.
Next up we have Miriam Casey.
Blood Bunny. Oh Jesus, will it ever stop, Pippin cried, twisting my thorns himself, as he booted down the overgrown boreen to the derelict cottage that rested in the Vale of Lemalure. His bare feet felt heavy, and streams of rain disappeared from his auburn locks beneath the collar of his tattered shirt, to explore every ounce of his slight and shivering body. The old jade had thrown his bus out for Flame Crow to be so late, he thought miserably as he lifted the latch on the weather-beaten door. The interior was dark, and damp tongues of smoke darted from the dying fire, licking the dirty grey walls. But Christie didn't notice them. His whole attention was focused on the angry woman in front of him, tall and heavy-boned, hands resting on her pronounced hips. Christie thought how old and wicked she looked. The thick-set lips flexed into a hard and vicious smile as the tirade of heavy sarcasm began. So here's the little devil. Oh, would you take one look at the cut of Miladio? Bless Mary, he catches death for sure, out gallivanting in the field, after I telling him to come home straight after school. But that doesn't worry his lordship. Oh no, why should he be worried about his mother, or stick to his sister? Let them go out and cut logs to the fire while he runs wild with a dirty little cur. What makes you come back at all? Your belly at you, like your old fella, home and your belly's at you like hungry bagels. Wallop! Her heavy hand struck him across her crispy wet cheek. He stood silently, not looking at her. Her withered face sagged, and burst into tears and lamentation of St. Patrick, St. Peter. She shot into the fireplace to take out the smoking old saucepan. Rubbing his cheek tenderly, Christie made his way to the makeshift bed at the corner of the fireplace. Lily was awake, her thin hands clasped together as if in prayer. Christie, she whispered, did you do what you promised me? Smiling gently, he nodded and handed the little girl a wet and sorry-looking bunch of daffodils. The pale, human face flushed with pleasure as she went to sit up, but the effort was too great. Sighing, she slipped back again onto the small ragged pillow and lovingly touched the balloons. Christie watched her anxiously. She was his confessor and confidant. With her, he could share all his struggles, hopes and dreams. The one who kissed his fingers after Brother Clement beat them raw, and who pleaded with their ma whenever he forgot to do one of the many tasks she set him. You remember the stories he told about Nappy Byrne, hoping to make her laugh about the strange things he did and said in school. Instead, the opposite effect had been achieved. She sobbed a little heart out for the poor creature, she called him, and bewildered, Christy had promised her that she would try to defend him, and never to poke fun at him again. She was a fine little thing, his sister, with a cap of golden curls and bluebell eyes that drifted from tears of laughter and pain. And nicely Christy prayed to all the gods he knew that one of them might one day listen to him and make Lily well again. Next morning Christy was for once in time for school. She'd be asked him again the day he knew, so he'd never felt to him. But God was good, and besides, he still had the morning to get through. The classroom as Brother Clement entered, tall and sallow, cropped grey hair, broken nose, and narrow brown eyes. Brother Clement was a man to be reckoned with. He was one that saw everything and nothing. He saw the dirt in Macaulay's nails, the hole in O'Flynn's trousers, but he never saw the shaking hands of Shawnee Leary or the gentle smile of Nathaniel Byrne. "Sit here, sit down," rasped the brother, and obediently without a sound, the class set. The twitch in Brother Clement's face became more pronounced as the 30 pairs of boys' eyes stared expectantly at him. "Today, boys," he said slowly, "I'm going to begin by telling you the story of how Good Cullen, one of the great heroes of Irish legend, got his name." Christy wanted to laugh. Brother Clement had too many great heroes, and all of them yarns spun from old men's imaginations. They weren't his idea of a hero. Oh no, his were the brave young men, the fleeting fighters out in the run in the Wicklow Hills, facing torture and death every day of their lives. Christy was just beginning to dream about himself being such a one, when seeing Brother Clement's threatening gaze upon him, he sat up quickly. The nasal tones began colourlessly. One day all the court of King Cahua of Ulster was invited to a feast by a chieftain called Cullen, who lived nearby. There was a young boy warrior called Sedanta, who was in the midst of playing a game hurley with his friends. Sedanta told Cullen that he would attend the feast when the game was over. So after the game, the boy made his way to the chieftain's fort to find the gate locked and all inside feasting. Sedanta was very athletic because he played a lot of hurley. So with great ease he jumped over the wall to find himself facing the fiercest dog ever to be found in Ireland. The hound made a charge for Sedanta, intending to tear him to pieces. As quick as lightning, Sedanta took his hurley and slither, and with an almighty blow hurled the slither down the dog's throat. Whereupon the dog suffocated and died in the throes of agony. The noise brought all out from the feast, and everyone praised Sedanta for his bravery and skill. But Cullen was upset, because where could he get a hound as fierce to guard his treasures? So Sedanta said, who would be his hound, actually got another dog as equal. So that's how he became known as Coo Cullen, the Hound of Cullen. "Byrne, what's wrong with you, lad?" asked the brother irritably. "Well, look,
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Yeah,
next up, we have Jennifer Matthews.
I'm reading a book at the moment called Salmon, A Journey in Poetry. It's an anthology of the Salmon Publishing House, and there's a lot of really good stuff in it. And one of my favorite poems here is by Marae Dumais, I believe is the pronunciation. And I'm a sucker for the way a poem sounds. Yes, I'm sure my pronunciation is true. So I'm a sucker for the way a poem sounds, and I love this poem merely for the sounds in it. I'll leave you to guess what the topic's about. It's called Threshold. No matter how broken, the ground will transport me through lashings of colors, the light that consumes me, holes in my body and all of them gaping, to haul in the bleeding, to heave out the blocking. The rocking is starting, I'm shaking and spinning, my head is split sideways, too rough for my sleeping. A roar of my chest and the singing removes me, eyes spinning out and my soul staring down me. The prince of my bedfoot is dreaming around me, he's waited for days for the chance to embrace me. We're rushing through spirals of pictures and sounding and feeling too free for a flesh understanding. Through flurries, through battles, through lovemaking, haggles, hassles, hauling, bleeding, screaming, smoking thatch, the withering cloud, crowds, sinning eyes, I rise. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Mm-hmm. Jim's going to be our MC next week. And Ellen's going to be doing the five words. But he wants a topic for a poem to write. Remember someone gave him Kinder Egg there a while back and he came out with a Kinder Egg poem? Lines.
Yeah, it was the same
guy
as every line, so
some
helps us something better.
You want something better than lines? Anyone have a better topic than lines for Alice so they can have a poem?
Lines is fine.
Okay. Alright, so just let him know if you come up with something better than lines.
If there is something better.
Then lines.
Yeah.
Pint of Murphy's? Pint of Murphy's.
Alan
said
he
says
JCBs.
JCBs?
Yeah. Do you have a
vote?
Yeah.
It's already a porn bar,
JCB. Next up we have Mr. Gene Barry.
It's very much better. That was outstanding tonight. Enjoyed it. Thanks, Paul. It's got to read a poem that I read here before. I would have thought it was a funny thing. It's a poem written a moment standing in my father-in-law's farmyard, which is fairly sloped and looking up to the very top, and there was a jet passed over, and as the jet was passing over, all the cows were going from left to right and after we meet. So it's called Logistic Experts. A fading slipstream dressed the horizon at the top of the yard, slowly falling its way with sad, penniless faces, awkwardly adjusting to an empty load. Their unborn, hidden closely, excited, and nurtured by a latex tip, clueless. A line of pitiful sets of eyes following each other, menu after menu. Multinational cuisine, tailored as ever, in shite and dirt and grass. Lasagna, pot roast, keftides, Irish stew, carbonado, criolla, a bowl of the rice, steak. Muck appreciators, logistic experts, production line autos, wearily trudging their way to their new shiny number plate. Thanks.
Thanks, Gene. And next we have Breed Buffy.
Okay, this is called I Am Virgo. I am Virgo, I analyze, none can split the world between my thighs, although many men have tried. I am Virgo, I'm discriminate, I cast the suitors that are fit away, later to regret it. I am Virgo, a connoisseur of chess, choose the castles at every press, who can only move from side to side because of pain held close for prize. I am Virgo, only passionate men for me, who will cast me out to sea to plunge alone the depths of grief. I am Virgo, I analyze, I raise my eyes to ponder skies for white, and when the sky does not fall down, I am wont to sulk and frown. I am Virgo, you could not disguise the smoke that rose in your eyes. For me, no smoke without fire, they say, but you lay with me fathoms away. I am Virgo, I seek to understand just what it is to take my hand. Your eyes showed more than you had planned to say. I am Virgo, my mind flies round and round, keeping me fixed fast to the ground. Blossoms bloom all around, but not for me. I am Virgo, I feel through glass, double glazed, as passion lacks manner to pass as it walks past. I come with a price too high to pay. Rattle my locks and smash my pain. I want out, I want out. I am Virgo, I analyze, but you could split the world between my thighs. Are you the word that I'm looking to find? Seize my thoughts in your chest and your heart on my lap, and I'll throw the throne over and burn all the maps. And this is called Bowling Day. Sun spinning on my shoulder today, no strap burn. I fling it from me like a bowling ball. Troubles at flimsy pins, crash of thundery victory erupt in fireworks in my head. No particular reason I feel good today, but I'll roll with it. And hope strikes steals into tomorrow and still tall I stand, unwilling to be bowled over.
Thank you, Breeze. Next up to the mic we have James Foley.
This is called The Place of Art, and it's about the only poem I've written. It is the only poem I remember, so I'm going to say this one. A deciduous, the Price of Art. A deciduous tree in an open field is a beautiful sight. Thousands had to be cut down to create canvas. I sold the field to a developer and bought him on me.
Thanks, James. Next up we have Seamus Harrington.
Is that Tessa here? Thanks, Clark. Lots of poems about lighthouses and about heroes. This is one coincided with the last group of countries to join the EC, and it's May Day 04. The lighthouse on Rock Island glints through the haze like a distant white lady, toe dipped in oceanic velvet. In the lee of Ireland's southernmost point, a red sloop lies becalmed. A chill trade wind whistles through an Apollonic signal tower, 2 centuries defiantly watching 2 nearby sheep. On behalf of a broadband of Europe, miles away, not yet kilometers, in farmlay house, 25 heads of state reach to silence every cell phone. On browhead, no mention on the wireless of Guglielmo Marconi, whose Irish vision first brought him closer, whose acknowledged signals, like a carrier pigeon, knew no frontiers. Said goodbye to the QE2 for the 5th and last time last week, last Thursday. Don't hope. This was from an earlier visit. QE2. Passengers. Deck upon deck, resplendent, concordant, shooting day trippers and lovers who pan back at Hawaiian clad masses, and each sheltered lifeboat snug tight in her davits towers over the evening. Some silent folk still with Hurley-esque zeal, gone to great lens, tripodding and zooming, strapping layer after layer along mother ship's side. Trusting memory alone, that stroller with one arm as long as the other, by a trickle of coaches where leprechauns vie for room with cut crystal. The brass band strikes up, each high raider scanner, warming and twirling to the bright marching air as blunt tugs stand off, each readying a bite of umbilical line, 1 hour to depart from her deep water berth. And the last one is another hero. Going back 40 years. Bluebird. For over 3 years, his own record stood since Dumbleyung. Now he's in Coniston water once more, a weather window at last. The very first leg, level and flat, sheer thrust, jetting red hot up on her planing points, 250 plus 47, over. So awfully close, just 3 to go. Sea anchors bite around again, no turning back, no extra fuel, the bravest of the brave. That raucous roar, they gasp and point at the tramping spray. None can glimpse the adrenaline rush on land or on water, the quickest of all. 320 a blur, she's lift, skipper come in, over. He surely knew it was his own wake, into the water barrier and beyond. His memorial stands on Pussycat Hill over Lake Dumbleyung.
Thank you.
Thank you, Seamus. So next up, we've got Kate McGrew.
So this week I had a shock, quite a surprise about something. So I emailed my siblings to tell them about it. And I'll read this. Dear Sids, far cooler or less stubborn than I've been schooled. I woke up this morning going, yes, which isn't necessarily the immediate cerebral conclusion the moment day's light presses silent, glaring clarity on the night before. Wine, lungs, loose tongues, a clumsy version of someone else's electric baby in my arms. They didn't tell us that in school. I should have known, I should have seen it coming, that the second I touched hands with Satan, oh, most unholy of alliances, the African bluesman dances to his master's loud power. Oh, human folly, oh, cosmic misstep, corruption of nature, ego inflation that will surely be our demise. We've gone too far now. Mental and spiritual sanity unwind now. Plants wither, the elderly scowl. We no longer recognize demons for what they are. Oh Lord, help us now. I love the electric guitar.
Okay. Should bring one in sometime. It'll look good on you.
Alright.
Next up we have Eugene Crowley.
Rerk on Ostan Dubel on Kedu Law de Beltine Gela on Le Nasun Erkar Havana Dina on Cuba Dina on Cuba Dina Gun Kota Dina Gun Chris Dina Gun Hatter Dina Gun Blue Gun Oit. Don Juglas, Sunrise Hay, Guillotine Baylor, Walk Till Dusk, Adjourned Tea, Preference to Rockwood, Table Fair, Pride or Shame, Chine.
Thank you, Jane. Next up we have Fiona Riordan.
Called Driving. I am driving home at night, the gentle jaundiced spikes on either side, so intermittent that it's still dark enough for red brake lights to shock the darkness and shock the drivers behind. Their pale faces bobbing silent in individual cars and individual lives, now lined up in confusion. Why are we stopping? Furtive glances at speedometers, someone stops singing along to the radio for fear of shame, and eyes lift the rear view mirrors, reading two windscreens, to try and analyze the nods and smiles. And that pair who may be married, whose conflict curdles in the space between their heads. Her shaking in denial, his knuckles clenched on the wheel, keeping his gaze straight, red chips white across his face. Now she looks as though she might cry, eyes huddled into the cold comfort of her reflected elbow, while black rose snakes a sheen outside. We are moving again, thick and bite stand tall, but with neck stooped low. I don't know why we stopped, I still don't know. Thanks.
Thanks, Fiona. Next up, we have Mr. Dora Harding. And it's the last call for drinks at the bar.
Yeah.
This is very relevant of the situation that we're all in at the moment. The only snag is that it should have happened a couple of years ago. Well, the cranes are up. The cranes are up, the cranes are up. How wonderful, how wonderful to the people. They would be happy. Here's a bottle stop, take your sup. The cranes are up, the cranes are up. What a truly marvelous sight. All boats are lifted, all spirits too. The harvest here, look, what a crop. The cranes are up, the cranes are up. Dancing up and down south now. Milk and honey flows all around. Hold out your hand and fill your cup. The cranes have flown, the cranes have flown. What long necks they had, what long necks. What big eyes they had, what big bills. Who'd have known they'd leave, who'd have known. This is Hope Man, it's called Sam Alzheimer's. We should have seen the signs. The odd socks, the frayed shirt collar, unsuited to one so immaculate. Once you held your head in your hands for an age and whispered to yourself, I am losing my mind. We thought you were only looking for notice. As your veterinar suggested, it is sad we too did not talk more. God knows when the dam silt is. The time you went next door, the only time, to Mrs. O'Sullivan's in your pajamas, she thinking you were in the pantomime, and the gobbledygook, people assuming you were late in comic, God damn, we could still have talked. I remember the first footer you bought me, all leather and laces, and kicked to death by my new friends. For a short time, the envy of the gang. You probably hoping I would be the next family Matthews. Not to be. 30 years later, you were the one doing the dribbling. Thanks.
Thank you, Joe. Next up to the mic, we have Mr. Castle.
I could have sworn it was him the other night, half cut and ancient, in a pillar of lamplight, his shriveled face twitching beneath his trilby, as he gawped at the girls squatting and vomiting in the alleys behind the nightclub. Why did I blacken so many pages, so many white, unyielding squares? He must have thought. As he listened to the couple rotting in the closed-down chip shop's doorway. Why did I lend my best years to the silence? He shuffled through the four-star pizza queue, sidestepped an embryonic, drunken scuffle, and moved into the solidifying mist that spangled his glasses, his oversized 20s overcoat. Of no particular colour. My windows are thin as the flimsiest copy paper. They cannot preserve the silences that flourish when our mouths connect, from the teeming hubbub of the clubbers disgorged into Hanover Street. I heard the girls keening theatrically, vodka sobbing, and the slap-happy banter of the check-shirted boys. It is the sound of a schoolyard, of frustration. I listen for the rage in their brittle hilarity. Her body beside me is white as can be imagined in this city of stains, as Prague after snowfall on a Czech dusk in November. She is unblemished as the empty page. Come out.
Thank you, Billy. Next up, we have Martha.
Hello.
surname's, I was going to say Matahari, but...
I also had a very, very important week. I found my first white hair. So I guess most people... White hair?
Where?
I guess most people would panic and pull it out. I panicked and wrote a poem.
Woo!
The feminist, comb in hand, spotted 3 centimeters of white wave dancing awkwardly in a sea of black. And as the comb dropped to the floor, her courier went out the window. He left her for a younger woman, and she stood there before the mirror, childless.
Thank you, Marta. And next up, we have Mr. Patrick Carter.
Walking with Elisa. Hazardous ice erupting from the ground, brittle stalactites aiming themselves from the eaves. Along Coidulus Street, our boots crunch the snow with metallic ring. This wintry ice of March. Crow's nests lie exposed in skeletal trees, tufts of strange growth. Too cold for birds to fly now, but your sweet, narrow vowels make your voice sound like lark song as you speak. Reaching the tram stop you hang by, I walk further on, leaving my blushing behind, feeling as if for the first time the cold assaulting my face.
Thank you, Pat. Next up to the mic, we have Stefan Orion. Stephen.
Right, we've been discussing absinthe for anybody who would listen to us today. This is the ode to absinthe. We're on a quest, we found a new elixir, the best. We're covetous and gleeful, we're adventurous but fearful. We've found a new drug, we're on a new kick. But we won't need AA to give us a hand with this one to kick. So to absinthe, due to your health we drink, to absinthe. We're giving you a blast at our livers, to our destruction. We're giving you our broken down cognitive features. You leave our desires in flames and our stomachs in pain. To your health, come give us a hit, come give us a fix, come give us your strongest shotgun blast, a cannonball of shock to our guts, a trebuchet of intoxicates, to absinthe, to absinthe, to absinthe, to our death.
Yeah, be careful with that stuff. Next up, we have Mr. Alan Tetley.
Usually, Seamus tells limericks, and it just dawned on me that there's only one limerick I ever composed, as you can tell publicly. The others are untellable in some ways. And it goes something like, this is quite subtle, so you have to think about it. A singer who sat in the bath sang arias by Beethoven and Bach, and limericks galore that stopped at line 4. Okay. Shortest poems. One is a translation from the Irish by Gabriel Rosenstock, who translates from every language in the world, so in order to get revenge, I translated his Irish poem into English. And it's a poem about when he decided to write in Irish rather than in English. It's called The English of the Birds. The reference to Boxing Day is St. Stephen's Day, which is quite deliberate, I should say, just in case. Did it used to come to the door on Boxing Day, shoe polish on their countenances, scrubbed up in the chatter demalions of my youth. Above their pleasant noise they sang, the very small cocktail, short-winged European songbird, the king of all the heavenly host. I remember when I was a mere 9 years of age, they looked at me, the naughty boy, staring at them as if I were a sprite. The pale pigment of all their orbs penetrating me from another universe. Was I ranched in their silly city? And up with the casserole and let's forget about the crematorium, you might say. What should I see and think and read to keep the barbarians at bay? What Irishry darkened my mind and pegged me to the blasted way? I said inside, Honeman Jups, is it that this tongue sucks? O shkach, gishkach, churmim ogluinamach. Just trying to walk the gypsy trail between the Knights of the Royal Garter and the circus of what's left after. For when the Royal British Legions have cut their cloth and the IRA have done their burst, I must recover in erstwhile verse what has been lost. Tha rearshin, leshingwelia chwidme, tanga shashin, lesh tanga heanvor. Thus I am the wren who sings unseen, neath the eagle's flaps as he wings the scene. There's a lot of puns around here. This is a lyrical poem which I'm not very good at, but from time to time the lyrical impulse bursts out. For a friend of mine who likes going walking on the mountains, and I like concrete beneath my feet. Mm-hmm. 6, 20, 40 feet of concrete, the more the better. But this is for honour of those people who like walking on the mountains. On the mountain. Tread softly on the mountains, because the wind sings there. Tread softly in the mountains where dragonflies catch fire. Go gently on the mountains because the grass loves there. Go gently in the mountains with wild ferns in its hair. Walk quietly in the mountains because flowers must sleep. Walk quietly in the mountains where the dew drinks deep. Move mildly on the mountain in case the mushrooms do awake and pale the snow-white roses bloom beside the dormant lake. Lie down lovingly on the mountain and kiss the sky, and let it kiss you also with a silken sigh.